Good morning, Connecticut, to all our friends across the Sound. It's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, did you know that diabetes is the eighth leading cause of death in Connecticut? And March 22nd is Diabetes Alert Day. But with about two deaths every day being blamed on diabetes, we didn't want to wait another minute to bring you a candid conversation with one of our local experts on the subject from St. Francis Hospital. Then we'll get an eye inside the Connecticut State House with first-term Senator Tony Huang, who visited with us at our Hartford studios. We'll talk about how the state deficit seems to be spiraling out of control, along with several important bills the senator is supporting, and his efforts to help mitigate our state's looming financial crisis. Then we'll wrap up chatting with an individual who spent most of his life dedicated to the Connecticut-based global charity Save the Children and their important work here in the United States and across the globe. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this news. American Arts Marketing just announced a call for young artists to submit work for display and sale at the American Fine Craft Show to benefit the Connecticut Children's Medical Center. The creative works will be displayed at the XL Center on April 8th, 9th, and 10th. The Children's Art Week work should be based on a theme, family portrait. Entries will be divided into two groups, 8th grade and under, and grades 9 through 12. All Connecticut middle school and high schoolers are encouraged to submit entries, and they should be delivered via UPS, FedEx, or Postal Service in person to 242 Newberry Street, Hartford, no later than Thursday, April 7th. For information, call 860-956-9500 or visit AmericanFineCraftsShowHartford.com. We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. We're here with Senator Tony Huang. He is representing Connecticut's 28th Senatorial District down in Fairfield County. And as we indicated before we went on the break, he is a member of the Commerce and Veterans Affairs Committee. Speaking of veterans, Senator, you were talking a little bit before we went on the air about the success that Connecticut has apparently achieved in relation to I get emotional when I think about homeless veterans, particularly homeless women veterans that may have children. I know that you've talked to many of these individuals, but Connecticut has something to celebrate about veterans homelessness.
Absolutely. Homelessness is an issue that is under our control. We can eradicate that. We can give dignity and safety to every citizen in the state of Connecticut. And I want to compliment the governor for his leadership on this in eradicating chronic veterans homelessness. What does that mean? Chronic homelessness means someone that has been homeless for over a year. And the governor, through the leadership of the federal government as well, created an interagency cooperation, which incorporated Veterans Affairs, Housing, Department of Corrections, Department of Rehabilitative Services. It is a whole array of interconnected agencies actually cooperating with each other, actually cooperating and realizing that when there is an identification of a chronic veteran, that everything kicks in a unified, coordinated effort to make sure that that person is put into the cycle of getting into a permanent home situation. It is a remarkable efficiency of government that we so very rarely see. Mm-hmm. But what is done is to restore the dignity and the respect that every veteran who made the commitment to serve our country, to protect our rights and our values, they deserve. Sometimes when they come back from war and suffer the traumas of PTSD and mental illness or substance abuse, they get lost in our society. It is important that we should never, ever forget their contributions, men and women. Anyone who has served in our military deserves the utmost respect. And it's a compliment. It shows that when government and people work together toward a common goal, it can be done. So it's something I'm extremely proud of, and I hope that we will continue to use this template to eradicate homelessness in general, because everyone deserves a roof over their head and a safety of knowing that they will wake up in some place warm and safe every single day.
Yeah. Congratulations on that and great work. I could tell you that we talk so much on this program and really have for the past 28 years about addiction and, you know, issues related to drugs. We've been talking about the opiate epidemic, like crazy, on this program. And now it has elevated to a point of, being a national scourge. So I'd just like to take a minute or two at the moment just to talk about where the Connecticut Senate and our state house is as we speak today on issues related to the opioid epidemic.
It is an epidemic, and it is an epidemic that knows no socioeconomic separation. It's a devastation not only for those that are addicted, but for their families and loved ones. I think we have made an inroad in regards to prescriptive medicine opiates. We have also addressed some of the issues in regards to treating substance abuse addiction as an illness, not as a weakness of that individual. I think it's an incredibly important paradigm change. And I think the third is to recognize that there has to be parity, a parity of treatment and insurance protection, that people who have the right proper insurance should get that protection to ensure that people who are seeking help and treatment get that and do not get caught up in the insurance quagmire. People have a right to get better, and we have a responsibility to ensure that anyone who wants to do that or anyone who is caught up in the cycle of addiction has a chance to get better, has a chance to move forward with their lives.
So what are you signing on to or supporting as we speak in terms of opioid-related?
Well, we are initiating education and awareness and two parts. One, I was able to work with the Commissioner of Public Health to change the utilization of Narcan so that in the cases of overdoses that we get those type of medicine into the hands of our first responders. Let's save lives from overdoses, first and foremost. I think the second is to recognize that we have to create parity in treatment and insurance coverages for treatment centers, and recognizing that substance addiction is an illness and as such should be protected under insurance coverages.
Excellent. Finally, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes, maybe as much as 5 minutes, we'll push it to just come all the way back around. You've been talking about the need for structural changes in Connecticut's government and in the state house and in Hartford from day one, really. If you could share with the folks listening throughout Connecticut a couple of the most important things that you think and your colleagues think must really be done yesterday to start making some important changes that are going to help Connecticut sustain itself in the face of the departure of the GEs, in the face of the reduction of income tax revenue because of the loss of incomes, whether that just be people not getting raises or people leaving Connecticut who are earners. Tell us what are a couple of the things that Connecticut needs to do from a structural standpoint.
Well, John, the first thing is we have to approach this problem and admitting that there is a significant tax and spend problem. I truly believe that we don't have a revenue problem. I believe genuinely that we have a spending problem. With that said, I think a common sense approach, similar to what Connecticut households do, people sit across each other from the dinner table and recognize that we don't spend more than we make, that we have an understanding of accountability and a predictability and transparency with each other. I think those three critical words should be the fundamental of anything we do in state government. Let's be predictable, let's be accountable, and let's be transparent. Let's talk and work with each other. One such aspect is we have not voted on a labor contract in the state of Connecticut for over 20 years. We have been able to just pass contracts with increases in salary and benefits without any true accountability in over 20 years. Now, in light of these very difficult situations, just tremendously breathtakingly shocking budget deficit numbers. We just had a vote for the first time in many years that I remember on the UConn professor's budget. Now, UConn had a range of a 31% tuition increase on students and their families. Mm. And at the same time, they proposed a budget that increases spending and salary increases for staff. You would think that we would understand and put a stop to it. But remarkably, for the first time, there's true accountability, and the House voted to pass a budget like that. That is where accountability and transparency comes into play. We need to do better. There's so many things we need to do. We need to correct pension liability. We need to repair our dual delivery system in our state, where the Department of Development Services do the same thing as so many of our great nonprofits. There has to be a greater efficiency in government services.
Excellent. We're going to tag that with "to be continued." Lots more to talk about with Senator Tony Huang, but our time for today is short, so we will say farewell for the moment, but we promise to come back around and talk some more about this in the future, and maybe you can bring some colleagues with you on your next visit, and we'll drill in a little bit deeper as the session rolls on in a few weeks.
John, it's great to be here, and the title of your show, "For the People," is such a wonderfully apt title. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Senator Tony Huang, he represents Connecticut's 28th District, which includes Easton, Fairfield, Newtown, Weston, and Westport. He is a ranking member of the Housing and Labor and Public Employees Committee, as well as a member of Commerce and Veterans Affairs. Thank you, Senator, for being part of the program here this morning. It's been way too long since we touched base with our friends at Save the Children, Connecticut-based, but doing so much incredible work around the globe and here around the country, even right here in Connecticut, I think. Gary Shea is with us. He's Senior Director for Board Relations and Emergency Operations for Save the Children. He works in the Resource Development Department for this global organization, certainly an organization I've known about since my childhood back in the 60s when we were doing little neighborhood fundraisers for the organization and in our schools. Save the Children invests in childhood every day in times of crisis in the United States and around the world. As we said, they give children a healthy start, an opportunity to learn, and they protect children from harm. So, Gary, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on. I look forward to speaking with you about Save the Children today.
So beyond that that introduction and that little bit of personal anecdote, let's talk about the incredible history of this organization that it has been rooted here and really not just doing incredible work, but really representing Connecticut in sometimes the darkest corners of the globe.
No, Save the Children, since 1932, when our U.S. chapter was founded, has worked here in the United States. And actually, we began our programs in Kentucky, mm-hmm. Here in the U.S. And since that time, have expanded programs to 16 states here in the U.S., and as well as 120 countries around the world. And I've had the great privilege of working with Save the Children now for over 40 years. Mm. Half of that time was spent overseas, managing our programs in the Dominican Republic, in both Nepal and Bolivia. I spent 7 years in each of those two countries. And my last overseas assignment was managing our earthquake response in Haiti, where I lived for 2 years. So I've watched Save the Children programs expand around the world, and I've personally seen, you know, how we change lives for children, both here in the U.S. and internationally.
Mm. With the incredible history that you have with Save the Children, Gary, I'm interested in hearing a little bit about the difference between then and now. I guess I hear all the time in a lot of ways, you know, technology is a fantastic thing. It's really made the world a smaller place, but in some respects, a lot of people wish that they weren't weren't so chained to it. Can you look back in your early days with the organization and talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you had then that now here 30, 40 years later, you know, has been made easier as the world has progressed?
Sure. You know, from some of my initial experiences with Save the Children in the Dominican Republic, which I think most people probably know through tourism, I lived up in a small rural town in the northwestern corner of the Dominican Republic, right along the Haitian border. When we needed to make a phone call, I'd have to drive an hour and a half because there was no phone service in the town. My way of communication with our office was either through mail, regular mail, or I could send a telegram, and that was, you know, many years ago. And then when I was in Nepal, which now has cell phones, I would leave the office monthly trips to the rural areas in which we worked. When we first started in 1980 in Nepal, it would be a five-hour drive and then a 2 to 6 hour walk. And from the moment I left the office, people, if they were looking for me from the U.S. or in Nepal, Gary will be back this day. He's unreachable. And as we began to expand our programs, actually to the very areas that were affected by this year's earthquake in Nepal, some of the trips would be 2 weeks, and I would have to walk 4 and 5 days to get to the remote communities in which we're working, and then, you know, spend time visiting the different villages, talking about the programs, and then come back by foot for the first part, and then by land, usually the last 5 or 6 hours. And, you know, to the point you made about technology, technology has really made our work so much easier, especially in times of emergencies. Mm-hmm. I mean, the earthquake in Nepal, which was devastating, the one that occurred last year, that would have taken a very, very long time to get information out about these remote communities, how they were affected, and what the needs are. And that makes it much easier, not that it's not challenging, but much easier to get the help we need as quickly as we can to the people who need it most. So technology helps us keep the public informed about what we're doing. It helps us ensure staff safety. If you think, and it's, we have large programs in the Middle East, we always want to know how our staff are. You know, having cell phones and excellent communication protects our staff and allows us to serve more and more children around the world.
And what, now these so many years ago, what was it that brought you to Save the Children? Did you have background, or were you well traveled at that point and knew that that good work was needed in some of these other more remote areas of the world? How did you come onto this job?
Well, like many of the people at Save the Children, certainly from our staff here in the U.S., I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I had the opportunity to be a Peace Corps volunteer in the highlands of Peru. I really enjoyed what I did. I worked with craftsmen who were selling their products in the southern part of Peru, not far from Machu Picchu, down toward the Bolivian border. And that was a really positive experience. And while I was in the Peace Corps, and I had studied hotel management at Cornell, I felt I could apply some of the skills I learned in terms of business skills, management skills, personnel skills, communication skills in a development setting. So I applied, you know, for graduate school. I got a master's degree in international relations. And then I was offered an internship with Save the Children back in 1975. And that's when I was assigned to the Dominican Republic, first as an intern. And then I stayed for 3 more years in the Dominican Republic, then moved back and forth between headquarters and field positions. So after that Peace Corps experience, like many others who've had similar experiences, I decided I want to dedicate, you know, my life and my career to working with people, both in the U.S. and internationally. And I'm not a unique case. There are many people with similar backgrounds, and there are people from similar backgrounds who are from the U.K. or from Norway or Sweden or Netherlands, who all had an extended volunteer experience and made a career change as a result of that. And I think a lot of that was because I could see the impact, you know, when programs are well designed, the impact they can have and give people the opportunities that, you know, I've had and most of our listeners have had here in the States of a good education, what we say, and a healthy start. And you know, with resources provided by Save the Children sponsors, we've been able to do that.
And I imagine that the young people that are coming into the agency to volunteer or work today aren't all that much different.
You know, they're really not. I get to spend a lot of time with, you know, people coming out of undergraduate school, people with master's degrees, people who have the same aspirations I had. Usually they have it after they have one exposure to something different, and it can be both here in Kentucky or out on a Native American reservation. It doesn't always have to be international, and I know our chairwoman of the board, she was a VISTA volunteer in Kentucky. And last September, our board meeting was held in Kentucky, and she went back to some of the same communities that she had been a VISTA volunteer. So it's just something out of your comfort zone, and that often is an inspiration for people to look for a career in the not-for-profit sector, whether it's doing the work like Save the Children does through sponsorship and a humanitarian programs, or other groups that, you know, resettle refugees, help people with all sorts of social problems that we have, just a career of social service or development experience.
Excellent. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're with Gary Shea. He is with Save the Children, an organization you probably have heard about for many, many, many years. But now we're getting to know Save the Children through Gary's 40 years with the organization, doing such great work around the world and here in the United States. I guess one of the best ways that any individual might be able to make a difference is through Save the Children's Child Sponsorship Program. Gary, let folks know how that it's really like a one-on-one experience to some extent, although Save the Children is so such a huge organization and has such great influence and does such widespread good. Becoming a child sponsor really gives one individual the opportunity to connect to another.
It definitely does that. And I'm in my 30th year of being a child sponsor. I've sponsored children in Nepal and now in Bhutan. And as a result of that trip I mentioned to Kentucky last September, I'm sponsoring another child in Kentucky. And, you know, during my work experience with Save the Children, I've, you know, again, had the good fortune to work with sponsorship programs in the Dominican Republic, in Bolivia, in Haiti, and Nepal. So I've had a chance to not just be a sponsor, but also see the impact that child sponsorship can make. And when you sponsor a child, you really are helping that child and that community, but you're also helping every other child in the community. When Save the Children enters a community, which might be as large as a county or a cluster of communities, when we enter a community, we make a 8 to 12 year commitment to continue working in that community. We have proven programs that we can measure the results in health, in education, child protection, in some cases, safe water in schools and communities. And you are helping that entire community. And even though not every child in a community may be sponsored, every child will definitely benefit through the participation in the programs. The areas we focus on are education. Early childhood education. We want children to become literate. We want them to complete as many school years as possible. We work with teacher training. We make facilities improvement. What I talked about, school health and nutrition, because this is where children learn all about nutrition, hygiene, what foods can make a difference, exercise. And we work with parents as well as teachers. So oftentimes people say, I just want to build a school. And what we often say, yes, a good facility is important, but if we don't have trained teachers or we don't have, you know, perhaps technology in school and parents who take a real interest in it, we're not going to have the impact we have. And in many places, I know the other question I'm often asked, what's life like for a child in some of these countries in which we work? I know from my experience in Haiti, parents have to make extremely difficult choices because you would think in Haiti all schooling would be free, but there's often fees at school, you have to buy school uniforms. Parents often have to make the difficult choice of which child can go to school. which is hard. And a school might cost $20 just to get the school fees and things because the government doesn't have enough money to pay for all the teachers' salaries. So there may be private schools, and we also work with them because that gives more children a chance to go to school and have greater access. In terms of health care, we want all people to have access, mothers, to health care services. We want them, a woman when she's pregnant, to have access to prenatal care. And Save the Children works very closely with the health ministry of the countries in which we work so that these programs are sustainable. And I've seen firsthand, you know, just a story about, you know, the Dominican Republic. When I was there, we worked in a very small community on the Haitian border, and it was called Manuel Bueno. And we had a very active school teacher there who later became the head of the school. She would identify outlying communities where Save the Children would expand its program. And about 4 years ago, I learned she was now the governor of the province. Mm. So some of the leadership skills that people learn through their work with Save the Children, and some of them have it, you know, natural leadership skills. But I think working and developing the projects in their own community have now been taken to a higher level, and you have really strong people in leadership. And, you know, there are a couple of other stories, you know, just one story about Nepal, and this was all through child sponsorship. In Nepal, very few girls went to school during the time I lived there. And yet the women in the community and the young girls all wanted to study, become literate. So we often offered evening classes where women would walk with a lantern, sometimes as much as an hour from their home, and study for 2 or 3 hours. And there was one 14-year-old girl, her name was Bimala Shrestha, and Bimala completed the literacy class, and then she, I think she was 16, and she wanted to go back to primary school, and she was then put in primary school, and she was in fifth grade. I think she was like a foot taller than every other student. Mm-hmm. Well, Bimala completed her primary school. She finished eighth grade, went on to high school, and then went back to become a teacher in her community. Mm. So there are lots of examples like that where you see firsthand the impact of what sponsorship has done and can do working in partnership with communities.
Great. Well, in the last, we got about 30 seconds left. So the most important thing is to tell people how they can reach out with a very nominal amount of support and make that life-changing difference through Save the Children.
You call Allison at Save the Children and a member of her team at 1-800-728-3843. They can call Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, or they can log on to sponsor.savethechildren.org, and they can get all the information about sponsorship, how it benefits a child, how they can select one of the countries in which we're working, pick a boy or a girl, pick the U.S., and have that satisfying experience I've had. And that's why I've kept my sponsorship for so many years, because I've been, you know, I've been able to see the difference we've been able to make.
For the $3 or $4 a day, we might just blow on a tall cup of coffee. That money it can go so much further and make such a great difference if folks were willing to make the sacrifice, however small, on behalf of a child somewhere, even right here in the United States. We really appreciate the visit. Gary Shea is with Save the Children. He's the Senior Director of Board Relations and Emergency Operations, working in their Resource Development Department. Gary, great to meet you, and thanks for bringing Save the Children back on our airwaves and on the award-winning For the People. I really appreciate your time and your call, and we can't wait to speak with you guys again soon to find out all more about the great work that Save the Children is doing, both here in the United States and around the globe. Thank you.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. A Mexican fiesta party to benefit the Animal Haven is going to be held at Enchiladas Restaurant on Wednesday, March 9th. From 6 to 9. Enchiladas is at 3931 Whitney Avenue, adjacent to the Whitney Golf Club in Hamden. The Animal Haven is a private nonprofit charitable organization serving the greater New Haven area since 1948. It's a no-kill shelter whose mission is to provide a temporary, safe, caring, and humane refuge for homeless, adoptable cats and dogs, and to subsequently place those animals in quality, adoptive, permanent homes. Tickets for the event are $20 and include a taco bar and quesadillas, along with drink specials, raffles, music, and games. Tickets are available at Enchiladas, the Animal Haven, or by calling 203-249-7355 or emailing events at theanimalhaven.com.
We try to check in with medical experts a couple of times a year over something that is just a continuing health issue, not only here in our listening area, but across the country and around the world. I'm talking about diabetes. It affects more than 29 million Americans, about 9% of the United States population. And it's also estimated that one in every four people with diabetes may be unaware that they have the disease. We're so pleased today to welcome to the program a brand new friend from St. Francis. We're on the phone with Dr. Nate Lastman. He's head of the endocrine section at St. Francis and associate professor of endocrinology, University of Connecticut. Dr. Lastman, thanks for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I guess it's pretty disturbing that while this problem and issues related to diabetes seems to have so much education around it and so much public outreach, that the issue continues to apparently be getting a little bit worse. And I guess in Connecticut, and especially for certain populations, it is significantly worse.
You're absolutely right, especially in Hispanics and patients who are less educated, and it's very much associated, especially in what we call the type 2 patients, with obesity.
Mm-hmm. So let's get down to just some basic boilerplate then. First of all, exactly what is diabetes?
Well, diabetes basically is patients where their blood sugars are beginning to rise, and it's not being controlled by their own insulin. We divide the patients into both type 1 and type 2.
Mm-hmm.
Type 1 are patients who usually are younger, and their problem is an inability to make insulin. It's often genetic and often associated with what we call a self-destruction of the pancreas, the pancreas, which has the beta cells, which make insulin. And this is called an autoimmune phenomenon, where the patient's own immune system, which is supposed to fight disease, is actually fighting their own cells and decreasing the pancreas's ability to make insulin.
Hmm. Is the predisposition to type 1 diabetes tied to one's genetic makeup?
Absolutely. It tends to run in families. It doesn't mean that if one family member has diabetes that you're destined to have it. But as the number of family members increase, especially if it's on both sides of the family, then the chances of developing diabetes becomes higher and higher.
Mm-hmm. And I gather it's not as prolific as type 2 diabetes.
No, it's probably a 10-to-1 ratio, namely type 1 versus type 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the type 2 patients are patients who, when they initially present to us, they make plenty of insulin. They're making actually more insulin than even normal, but their body tends to be resistant to their own insulin, most often associated with obesity.
And so the issue with why we really need to continue the education and communication and perhaps even some other tactics to try to mitigate or reduce type 2 diabetes is because of the incredible and damaging ripple effects of it throughout the body.
You're absolutely correct, because increased cardiac disease, increased kidney failure, increased problems with ability to feel things, that is what we call neuropathies, are associated with the ravages of diabetes. But the biggest hope that we have is that the better the patients control their diabetes, the less these complications will occur.
Mm. And I'm seeing the statistics here. It is a major cause of death, two deaths per day in Connecticut, according to the latest, about two deaths a day as a result of diabetes here in Connecticut, the eighth leading cause, according to the latest statistics.
Yeah, the one hope we do have is that, at least in Connecticut, the rate of obesity tends to have stabilized out a little bit.
Mm.
And Connecticut is now only the 13th least obese state in the nation.
Oh, okay.
Most of these states that have the highest obesity rates tend to be in the warm weather areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great news, because as you may have known, our program was out there in front of the childhood obesity epidemic almost a decade ago. And now these, 5 to 15 year olds are now 15 to 25 or older. Can you talk a little bit about how the kind of explosion of childhood obesity over the past decade is playing into the whole situation now, and what you might be looking out for in the future? Or is there an anticipated bubble that we're going to hit when these folks get into their 30s and 40s, even if they have reduced their weight and put that back under control as they're into their late teens and 20s?
Oh, I think the hope is that as people become more aware and society becomes more aware of the fact that as we control obesity and junk food intake and increase our exercise programs, that we will not see a big bubble. I think the fact that the obesity rate is beginning to level off in Connecticut is certainly a hopeful finding. And I think the most important thing that we can say is that this is an epidemic. When I first was training and learning about endocrinology and diabetes, we rarely saw children with type 2 diabetes.
Mm.
Now it's so prevalent, it's just amazing.
Hmm.
But with the leveling off of the obesity and with a decrease in the obesity rate that I hopefully we'll see, and the emphasis that you can prevent so many patients from getting diabetes, I think is hopefully will be a wonderful future for us.
Good. We are about halfway through an engaging chat with Dr. Nate Lastman. He's head of endocrine section at St. Francis in Hartford and associate professor of endocrinology for UConn. We wanted to remind you that according to the American Diabetes Association, Diabetes Association Alert Day is observed annually on the fourth Tuesday in March. It's a one-day wake-up call to inform the American public about the seriousness of diabetes, particularly when diabetes is left undiagnosed or untreated. This year, Diabetes Alert Day is Tuesday, March 22nd, but that won't stop our award-winning For the People from continuing to bring guests to you like our Dr. Lastman to talk about the issue as often as we can. So Dr. Lastman, before we went on the air, you were mentioning an interesting situation that kind of started in Scandinavia, but that we actually talked about a little bit with guests on our program over the past few years, where American industry and businesses are getting involved in helping incent their employees to adopt lifestyle practices and other behaviors that are probably contributing to this leveling off of the diabetes issue here in Connecticut, right?
I think so, and I think that getting industry involved, getting pretty much employers involved is most helpful. I think some of the original studies came actually out of Finland. You're right, Scandinavia, and where they found that their benefit checks actually were reduced if they didn't participate in both a dietary program and an exercise program. So that it's this carrot and stick approach that if there's something in addition to just a health benefit is offered to the patients, but really an additional financial benefit, that these programs work. There are other programs where industry itself, and some of these have recently been published in some of our prestigious magazines, like New England Journal of Medicine, and they have shown that when patients participate in these programs, that there are significant health benefits. Here at St. Francis Hospital, there are programs sponsored for our employees where their insurance premiums are reduced if they participate in and complete both a dietary and an exercise program. And I fully expect that data coming out of our program will correlate with what we're seeing nationally and many of these other big programs by fairly large employers.
Oh, well, that's great news. For folks who might not have the benefit of that type of relationship or situation in their with their employer, can you just talk a little bit in the last couple of minutes that we have with you about what individuals who may know that they're at risk because of family history, or who may think they're at risk, or even maybe that have no suspicion whatsoever that they might be in a pre-diabetes situation, what do they need to do when they're interacting with their healthcare providers?
I think there we have a test which is now easy. We used to use these so-called glucose tolerance tests, where we gave patients a load of sugar water and measured their blood sugars. But there's a simple test that we have, a test that we call the hemoglobin A1C. And those patients who have hemoglobin A1Cs that are beginning to rise but not yet into the diabetes range, we can say, you know, you have prediabetes, and if you follow a diet, if you get some weight off, if you're on an exercise program, you can probably either delay or hopefully prevent the onset of overt diabetes.
Good news. I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us this morning. Here we are in March, coming up on Tuesday, March 22nd. It's American Diabetes Association Alert Day, when folks throughout the United States talk a little bit more and get a little bit more heightened promotion about the seriousness of diabetes, particularly when it's left undiagnosed or untreated. Our guest this morning is Dr. Nate Lastman. He's the head of the endocrine section at St. Francis and associate professor of endocrinology for UConn. Dr. Lastman, thank you so much for your time this morning and that great information.
It was a pleasure, and I very much appreciate chatting with you this morning.
I have known Senator Tony Wong since he was elected, even before that, when he was a public servant here in Connecticut. And I'm pleased that he's the very first guest to sit down at our Hartford studios for the award-winning For the People. And certainly lots to talk about, so we don't want to spend a lot of time in the introduction phase, because the folks at Connecticut really deserve to know a lot of the information that you're privy to, Senator Wong, because you're inside the bubble, so to speak, in Hartford, and you know, the numbers just keep getting crazier and crazier. So we're going to spend probably the second half of the two segments that we have with you this morning really drilling into the budget. But first and foremost, we want to talk about a couple of other important points. You're a longtime resident down in Fairfield. General Electric was a massive, the highest taxpayer in Fairfield, and certainly many of the employees there lived in and around Fairfield and Fairfield County, and now GE is gone. So tell us a couple of the most important things that Connecticut residents need to know today. GE and its departure has been talked about, the threat certainly for well over a year, the reality for months, and now here we are, you know, probably 3 months or so post-announcement. What do folks in Connecticut need to know about the GE departure? Maybe debunk some of the rumors or some of the misconceptions that are going on around the state.
Well, John, it's great to be here on the show. And I think GE is such an iconic worldwide name. And I think their leaving of Connecticut is really a punch in the stomach to our state's prestige, and a sense of reassessment of where we are going to go into the future without GE. It is all about jobs, taxes, and the state of our economy when we hear all the debates back and forth about GE. But I want to take a step back and talk about the GE that I know, which is a reflection of the neighbors and their contributions in the community beyond what is simply in the business pages. GE had about 800 employees at their corporate headquarters based in Fairfield. They are scattered throughout suburban southwestern Connecticut. But they are also my neighbors. They are also people that I have valued and cherished as community advocates and volunteers. So many of the GE employees give back to their community. That is one aspect of their corporate culture. So many of them are an integral part of parents and community clubs, and they make our community special. And the other part is their foundation work, as well as their matching grants of their employees to our nonprofits, are incredible. They are so vast that sometimes we take it for granted. I recently did a forum in which we collected a lot of the nonprofits and asked what GE meant to them. We had the Child and Guidance Center of Southwestern Connecticut, which revealed that close to 6.5% of their operating budget was from GE donations and contributions. The Southwestern Connecticut Coastal YMCA literally has nearly $7 million of donations and contributions and foundational support from GE. All that goes away when they leave. And those are consequences that really come back into our neighborhood. And it's a privilege to represent Newtown. Mm. And GE donated $15 million as part of the foundation to rebuilding a sense of the community center that is going to be a revitalization of people believing in communities. Mm. Those go. And where are we going to make that difference up? And that is something that I'm trying to get the community to understand. We are a great community. We're a great state. But we need to understand our resolution to move forward and support our nonprofits, yeah, make up the difference of the GE.
And as far as you know, there's no stepping down or weaning off. These are 1 year, the grants and support are here. And for the most part, the next year, once GE is actually formally relocated and established in the Boston area, then they're gone. There's no, they'll continue, you know, 50% year two, 25% year three, and then year four, you're on your own. This is, for the most part, the idea is once they flip the switch to their new relocation headquarters, then that's it for many of the Connecticut recipients of their philanthropy?
Unfortunately, that has shown itself to be that reality. I wish they would, scatter that and taper it down. But unfortunately, you're talking about people's connections to communities. It's very hard for them to understand and to give. And you know what? What makes it so much more painful is the fact that I'm not sure they would have left if we had not done the proper things as a state in our legislative leadership.
Yeah.
And I hesitated on that because to this moment, I struggle with that because we could have done more. We could have done better to keep GE in our community.
Yeah, but I guess the reality is if they wanted the energy of one of America's biggest cities and the IT and the pharmaceutical and the scientific brain pool that centers around Boston, maybe there wouldn't have been anything we could do in terms of throwing money at the issue, so to speak. It's a hard call to make, but certainly that does not negate what Connecticut is losing here. You said it when you first began speaking, the prestige of that global brand and calling Connecticut home, and the fact that it appears they've basically like left Connecticut to go to a place that's better for GE.
Well, it's very important. You bring up a great point, and I think the distinction has to be what drove GE out of Connecticut is a distinctly different measure of why they chose Boston. Let me clarify that by saying the reason what drove GE out of Connecticut was a untenable budget situation that will only get worse, a pension liability that has no discipline, and that there is no means of discipline in how we manage our budget and the liabilities down the road. So it's a tax and spend policy, and taxes are a huge factor. That led them to decide to leave Connecticut. Once that decision occurred, the reevaluation of locations from Atlanta to Texas, Ohio, and Boston came into play of what would be the best environment. And we still had an opportunity in that because when you just describe all the scenarios, an offer was made to take over vacated space in Stanford from RBS and UBS that has train lines, that has an urban connection. Yeah. It has access to universities and New York.
Yep.
New York, the hub of internet vibrancy and rebranding, and still have the best of both worlds, New York and Connecticut. They chose to leave Connecticut because of the environment, the ecosystem that was unsustainable in governance.
Yeah.
They chose in that opportunity to move to something that was much more palatable. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and I think the opportunity, the O word is the key one there because they may have not started looking had there not been this history. So we can definitely agree on that point. You also mentioned GE's philanthropy toward Newtown, and certainly your being on hand from day one post-1214 in Newtown has played a critical role in a lot of the things you've done at the state level. Your legislation on school threats is before your colleagues now. Tell us a little bit about the progress and purpose behind that idea.
The idea was brought forth to me by constituents in Sandy Hook. The Reedys, the family, had children at St. Rose Lima, and they were subjected to terroristic acts, which created tremendous trauma and terror among the students, among the faculty, and among parents. And they brought forth and said, our current state statutes treat threats as a normal threat between you and I. There is no specific protection for schools. And in evaluating that, we approached it and said there is a epidemic of these kind of threats that are no longer the past of pranks, of pulling a fire alarm or making a call because you want to skip a test. these are now very sophisticated and intended threats to create terror.
And the outcome of those threats is not, it's not just, oh, we put a bomb in the school, ha, 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 and hang up. They're detailed, and they are, in some cases, describing terroristic outcomes of the damage.
And that's, unfortunately, the world we have evolved to.
Yeah.
And what this intent of this bill is in three forms. One, first and foremost, to adapt our penalties and statutes and letting people know that this is unacceptable in any way, but it is especially untenable, in my mind, when it comes to schools and protecting our children, our educators, and a parent's peace of mind. I think the second thing is to raise the awareness of this is not acceptable even as a prank, and that you know, we are going to take the approach in the environment we live in that if you see something, say something. And the third part of the nuance of it that came to me was, as a parent who send off your children to go to school, there's nothing more important to ensure that they are there safe and that they come home safe. This gives a degree of control back to our parents and educators to say that we as legislative leaders have their best interest in mind and will do everything in our power to give control back to them, that the people that will perpetrate these crimes of terror will be caught, and when they're caught, they will be punished to the highest level under the law.
Well, I hope that this year there's success with that initiative. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Senator Tony Huang. He represents Connecticut's 28th Senatorial District, which includes Easton, Fairfield, Newtown, Weston, and Westport. He's ranking member of the Housing and Labor and Public Employees Committees and is a member of the Commerce and Veterans Affairs Committee. We're going to come back after a brief break and talk a little bit about how proud he is to be affiliated with initiatives to deal with homelessness, particularly veterans homelessness. So we'll touch on the opiate epidemic and the work that we're doing in the current session on that. And we'll talk about Senator Huang's idea for some critical structural changes he feels need to be initiated in Hartford in order to bring Connecticut successfully further into the 21st century. We'll be back. Stick with us.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.